I'd like to welcome everybody to the Second Court of Appeals for our second session of oral arguments this morning. We'll hear two cases starting now at 10:30. Before we start, let me introduce our panel. To my left is visiting Judge Michael Massengale, who we're delighted to have up here with us from Houston. And to my right is Justice Wade Birdwell, and I'm Elizabeth Kerr. And I understand everybody's here and has checked in for our two 10:30 cases. So, without further ado, we will get started. If the clerk will call the first case.
The court will now call Marvin Rodriguez versus the State of Texas. May it please the court, this is Jimmy Dickinson to argue for the appellate, and Mr. Landon Wade to argue for the state.
Thank you. You may begin.
Good morning. May it please the court. This murder prosecution arose out of a shooting that, in turn, arose from a riotous melee and fist fight that took place in the parking lot of AT&T Stadium. Appellant, Mr. Rodriguez, testified that he was in fear of his life and that of his brother when he shot Mr. Sells. This was a very long trial, comparatively speaking, and the defense's theory mostly revolved around this self-defense. Unfortunately, the trial court didn't give appellant any of his requested self-defense instructions, and thus that's the main point in our appeal and the main thing that I'm going to discuss today. So the first issue is whether there was evidence that would justify a self-defense charge. Now, the state's argument boils down to, well, yeah, appellant testified to this, but that's not what other witnesses saw, or that's not how we see the evidence. In other words, they seem to be looking at it in the light least favorable to the defendant, but that's not right. It's helpful to remember kind of the buzzwords for the standard that we want to use. I mean, it should be in the light most favorable to the defendant. It's whether the evidence is weak or strong, unimpeached or contradicted from any source. And it just, appellant didn't describe just simply one punch, which many of the cases that the state relies on essentially say, well, a punch is not deadly force. Well, I certainly would agree with that. The problem is that that's not what happened here, and it's not what appellant testified to. In a short summary, he testified with regard to his brother, Candido, that Candido was forced on the ground, face down. There were about five men around him. There were fists flying everywhere. Candido was screaming, and someone was leaning on Candido's back, kneeling with his knee on his back. And Candido testified to this too. Obviously, Candido can't get into appellant's mind, but he more or less backed up appellant's version of events. So appellant testified that, indeed, he thought Candido's life was in danger, and his own when the gang turned on him. Our point is that appellant testified that he was in fear of his life and Candido, and that this fear was reasonable based on the evidence at trial. And the cases that the state relies on are largely distinguishable. For example, in Schiffert, which is another one of those punches aren't deadly force cases, well, the problem with that is that Schiffert actually got an instruction. It came up in the context of an egregious harm analysis, and the court said, well, there wasn't really enough evidence of deadly force anyway, but in the appellant's case, of course, he didn't get an instruction at all, and he should have. Trammell. Also very different facts. In that case, there really wasn't much dispute that was a purely verbal confrontation. I believe the victim in that case was in a car. He had earlier, sometime before, pulled a knife on the defendant, but nothing was happening at the time that the defendant killed him. Warner, also cited by the state, that, again, didn't have to do with instruction per se. It had to do with whether evidence was admissible. But what I think is interesting about Warner, which is a case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, was that that language was quoted and modified, I guess, in Hamel at 916 Southwest 2nd 491 by the Court of Criminal Appeals. And it's helpful just to quote it a little bit. Quote, Warner should not be interpreted to preclude a self-defense instruction where the defendant reasonably perceives that he is in danger, even though that perception may be incorrect. And that's what we regard as happening now. It's the reason why we look at this in the light most favorable to the defendant. It's because he's the one who's out there. He's the one who has to make a decision about whether to protect himself or a third person. And the idea is reasonable perception. And in this case, it does come down to a certain amount of reasonableness. If he testified, this is not a situation where he says without any explanation at all, well, I felt in fear of my life, such as would be the case in Trammell, for example. Here he backed it up with an explanation of what made him perceive the danger. Whether he's wrong or not is not a question for the trial court to consider. That would be a question for the jury once they get the instruction, which he should have had.
Counsel, what about the confession and avoidance argument that the state raises?
That's great timing. I was just getting perfect. Confession and avoidance. Well, that's an interesting point because my view is the Court of Criminal Appeals has seen that at least as it existed in the early days, it's pretty draconian to say that a person has to get up and testify to each element of the offense. And I think that the state and I agree that that's not necessarily true. Gamino makes it clear that a defendant doesn't have to admit to every element of an offense.
It's still a justification defense, though.
It is a justification
and
defense.
And he has to justify what, in fact, he did.
Exactly.
Okay, and so the question becomes, is there evidence of justification of going to get his gun? Is there evidence of justification for bringing his gun to what he perceives to be a fight? Is there justification for putting a gun to Mr. Peters' head when he's not, in fact, doing anything to his brother? Okay. Is there justification for putting the gun to the head of Mr. Sells? And then is there justification for the thing that actually killed Mr. Sells, which was the discharge of the weapon? And what my understanding of what the state's arguing is that Mr. Rodriguez, at no point in time, for purposes of saying he was justified in doing what he did he say he was justified in the discharge of the weapon? Everything is he was justified in bringing the weapon, in pointing the weapon, but there's absolutely no evidence in the record of his saying that he was justified in the discharge of the weapon. In fact, everything he says is I had no intent whatsoever to discharge the weapon.
That's exactly what he testified to, was it not intentionally, when asked, did you shoot him? And that's our point with regard to the Martinez case from the Court of Criminal Appeals, which both of us argue about in our briefs. In Martinez, the testimony from Martinez was that essentially he fired a shot in the air, I think, and then he pointed the weapon. And there was some testimony, I believe, that
his mother or something.
Right. The extent of his testimony was that his finger was on the trigger, and then his mother somehow pressed the finger and caused the gun to go off, resulting in the death of the victim. And the court, in my view, rightly said, well, that's he admitted enough of the conduct. He was there in that position, ready to defend himself. That's the whole point.
What was the intent charged in that case? Was it knowingly, intentionally, or recklessly?
I don't remember, Judge.
Okay, would that have had any effect? Because given the fact that the discharge involved a third person, like in this case?
Well, I would argue.
Could you admit to the recklessness of bringing a gun and then putting a third party in a position of doing it?
I think you could. I don't think that would preclude someone in a case where it was charged only as intentional or knowing from justifying their actions by pointing the gun or what. I mean, in other words, from the defendant's point of view, it doesn't really matter how the offense is charged. Or at least from Gamino and Martinez, I think we can pull out from the rationale that the important part is that, you know, you admit to the conduct, essentially, and not, oh, I intended to do it, or I was reckless about that, or I acted negligently when I pointed the gun at that man. I don't think that that...
In other words, you don't ever actually have to say I was justified in doing what happened.
Well, I think you have
or
to
you point... Or you can stop at a... Yeah, I was justified here, but I'm not going to go to the actual criminal conduct for which I'm being prosecuted and say I was justified in doing it. But because I confess to justification, or I'm arguing justification up to a certain point, then I get to submit that to the jury.
Well, you are. When you say the specific conduct, do you mean
the discharge of the weapon that killed Mr. Sells? Yes.
Or do you mean in addition to the mental element that is that he's accused of acting under, I guess? Or are you just speaking
he
about
doesn't
the
even admit
itself?
He doesn't even admit to the actual discharge of the weapon.
Well, I would disagree with that.
He says the weapon's in his hand, but the actual thing that caused the discharge, he had absolutely no control over it. That's his testimony.
He said it went off, and when asked, did you shoot Mr. Sells, he said, not intentionally. I'll agree that that's ambiguous to a certain extent, but I think that a reasonable reading of an answer to the question of, did you shoot him not intentionally, would be, well, yeah, but I didn't mean to. Sure, would it have been better if he said, yeah, I shot him? But that's not what happened. And it's still...
So, no, it's a reasonable inference if you put a gun to somebody's head and it discharges into their head that, yeah, you've pretty much admitted that you're the cause of the discharge.
Well, clearly he's... And that's more or less not only our argument, but I think that's the point to Martinez, which... And I was going to go back to your earlier question about sort of lower mental elements. I don't remember that being part of the rationale. It seemed fairly wide-ranging that admitting to the conduct in most cases should be enough of a justification, as you put it, and enough to sort of get over that confession and avoidance hurdle, if you will.
It does seem like it depends on what offense you're talking about, because if the jury had convicted him for manslaughter, then it would make sense to talk about, was he justified in simply bringing the gun and having the gun and putting himself in a circumstance where the manslaughter could occur. But if instead the jury has found him guilty of murder and has found that he did it intentionally, then just being justified in bringing the gun with him doesn't really give him the justification he's looking for.
No, but our position my answer to that would be that, well, he testified to more than simply bringing the gun. I mean, that was obviously part of it. I still hold to the fact that he did enough to indicate that, yeah, I shot him, but I didn't mean to, more or less. And I think that the other issue with that, and I'm not trying to avoid the question, but that almost goes to a harm issue in a way. It's like, if we're going to look at what the jury eventually did, you know, our position would be that, but he deserved the instruction. We should look at what the evidence was at the time.
Okay, let's assume hypothetically that this isn't an accidental discharge case, that in fact, Mr. Rodriguez is actually standing back from what he's perceiving, and he puts a bullet in Mr. Sells' head while he's on top of his brother hitting him. The state argues that merely being on top of his brother hitting him is not the use of lethal force which would justify the use of a bullet to the head. What's your response to that?
Well, excuse me. My response is essentially what I was arguing earlier, that from his, we're supposed to look at this from the perception of the defendant and his, where he's standing. From his perception, his brother was in real trouble. I don't think that if the cases stand for anything, they don't stand for some sort of blanket sort of prohibition, I suppose, on a self-defense instruction on the basis of certain acts that the state may argue are merely minor. I mean, you know, to put it in one way, yeah, it's a fist fight. To put it in another way, as Dr. Weathers testified, but couldn't testify in front of the jury, this is a giant melee. It's not some sort of, it's not a little fisticuffs thing under the Queensbury rules. And part of that is, there's five people around his brother. One of them's kneeling, perhaps with all his weight on his back, his face down at one point.
And he manages to get through the five around to get to Mr. Sells, who's on top.
I'm sorry, could you say that again?
I'm sorry. He manages to get through the five that are surrounding his brother to get to the guy who's on top and put a gun to his head.
That's right. But again, that would come under the heading of his perception might have been mistaken. But that doesn't make it unreasonable under the law.
Thank you, Mr. Gibson. Your time is up.
Thank you very much.
Clerk, would you add 1 minute to Mr. Wade's time, please?
May it please the court. As appellant did, the state is going to focus its arguments on the court's charge in this case, and specifically appellant's requested instructions for self-defense and defense of third persons. Regarding these instructions, the state's position is that appellant was not entitled to them at all, even when viewed in the light most favorable to him and his request. And that's for two reasons. First, appellant did not show that the victim in this case, Richard Sells, used or threatened to use deadly force against either appellant himself or anybody involved in that fight. And second, and most importantly, I believe, appellant did not admit to the charged conduct in this case and thereby didn't satisfy the requirements of the confession and avoidance doctrine. So to receive an instruction on deadly force and self-defense, the defendant must make a threshold showing of deadly force on part of the victim, and that comes from the Werner versus State case. And here, appellant simply did not make that showing. The only evidence that Mr. Sells used any force at all came from appellant's testimony. Everyone else said either, you know, Mr. Sells was not involved in the fight.
That doesn't matter, right? It's, you know, if there's any evidence, no matter where it came from, whatever its weight, that's our standard of review, right?
That's correct, Your Honor. Okay. It is
so
in the light.
Mr. Gibson has argued that the case is about a punch not qualifying as unlawful deadly force are distinguishable from this circumstance where the allegation or the evidence was that that the complainant is on top of another person, putting all his weight on him, surrounded by other people who are kind of all beating him up. So what's your response to, you know, just the distinction of the facts or the evidence in this case versus those other cases that indicate that a single punch doesn't qualify as deadly force?
Well, my response to that would be the evidence of punching that the appellant testified to was pretty bare. He just said he saw Mr. Sells punching him, or he saw Mr. Sells punching his brother and kneeling on him, and it wasn't very descriptive, and from that, I don't think we can go to a point where we can actually...
Okay, well, isn't there other context of what other people were doing at the same time, allegedly?
Can you repeat that? I'm sorry.
Is there additional context, evidence from the appellant, about what other people were doing to his brother at the exact same time?
There was evidence.
And is that not context that would inform, possibly, a jury's determination of whether the person who's on top and administering the punches is administering unlawful deadly force.
Well, I think what we're looking at here is for the purposes of getting a self-defense instruction, just that narrow issue, we're supposed to look at the victim, just the victim, to see if there was any showing that that victim used or attempted to use deadly force.
There's no case law with regard to kind of a force multiplier. Is that what you're saying? In other words, your argument is essentially that because we have to focus solely on the victim as to whether or not the victim was applying lethal force that would justify the use of the legal force here, okay, that we cannot and the jury could not look at force multipliers, the fact that there were others who were doing the exact same thing at the same time.
Well,
how does that work?
Again,
in other words, if you are in fact justified, let's say there are four people around him with knives, and you just happen to shoot the one guy who doesn't have a knife but happens to be holding him down so that the other people could possibly use the knives. Are we to ignore the knives in the hands of the other four and look solely at the fact that this guy is actually holding him down? And therefore, because that's the only thing we can look at, there's no justification because he's just holding him, even though he's the one that's holding him for purposes of the use of lethal force by the other four? Is there not any case law that deals with kind of a force multiplier kind of like that?
I'm sure there is. I can't think of anything at this point, but really just for the purposes of the inclusion of self-defense, as far as you have to just, there has to be some threshold showing of deadly force of that particular victim, I believe.
Sure, and the question is, isn't there a difference between, so it's a third-person scenario, you look and see two men in a fist fight, and that's one circumstance in which you can analyze the question of whether the administration of punches qualifies as deadly force, and an alternative scenario where, let's just say, there are five men and one person's being held down and a person's on top with all of his weight bearing down on the person, you know, administering punches that, you know, to a person who's defenseless. Don't you think that those are distinguishable scenarios for purposes of determining whether or not that could be unlawful deadly force?
That could very well be, but in this case, I don't believe that was the issue or that was necessarily happening there. What I really want to focus on
his testimony is that all five individuals were punching his brother. His brother was defenseless, and his brother was indicating by his screams that, in fact, he was getting hurt pretty badly. So are you saying we can't take all of that, or the jury couldn't take all of that into account with regard to the subjective mindset of the defendant here?
I think that's something that the jury would naturally look at, but...
Then is not the jury entitled to an instruction from the court as to how they're supposed to look at that type of evidence?
If the defendant showed that the victim was using deadly force, then I think so. But I believe the other basis, probably the most compelling basis for affirming the appellant's conviction in this case, is the fact that he did not admit to the charged conduct and didn't satisfy the requirements of the confession and avoidance doctrine. And Justice Birdwell, you're exactly right when you were hitting on that. It's a justification defense. And so for the appellant to avail himself of that defense, he would have to admit to the charged conduct in this case.
And you don't think that the appellant saying not intentionally in response to the question about shooting Mr. Sells, that's not tantamount to confessing that he caused the shot?
No, I don't believe so. And the appellant was asked explicitly multiple times, did you shoot the gun? And he was very careful in his response to not go so far as to actually committing that act, to not actually shooting the gun. He said things to the effect of, unintentionally it went off. It went off while it was in my hand. He specifically said, the gun went off, rather than saying, yes, I shot the gun, but here's the reason why I did that.
Okay, let's distinguish this case then from Martinez, where there's an inadvertent discharge, okay? what was it in Martinez that made that, in fact, justification as opposed to, even though the gun went off with mom or stepmom or mother-in-law grabbing the arm type of thing, and this case in which the testimony, credible or not, is that both the victim and someone else caused the discharge?
Sure. Well, in Martinez, I believe that there, the appellant testified there, or the defendant at trial testified, that he perceived the victim coming at him and thought he was going to pull a knife on him. And so in response, he fired a warning shot into the air. But when he fired the warning shot into the air, he says that his mother-in-law grabbed his arm, and so that's what caused the bullet to hit the victim. And so basically
he was
saying...
Well, that was a second discharge, though. In other words...
Second discharge?
Was there not a second discharge? In other words, he fired something into the air, and then she grabbed it, and there was a second discharge. Was he intending to fire it into the air and got grabbed, and somehow the gun came down and...
That's
was it a single discharge or a double discharge?
That's what I believe to be the case, is a single discharge of him firing into the air, claiming that he fired into the air, but that the direction of the bullet was somehow influenced by somebody else. And so in that case, the way I would distinguish that is the fact that the alleged act was shooting a firearm. And by him saying that I shot the gun, I fired a warning shot, even though he didn't admit to intending to killing the victim, he still admitted to the charged conduct. Here, this is different because, you know, again, appellant was very careful to explicitly deny committing the charged conduct. And I believe this case is much more like the case the state cited in its brief, Ex Parte Naylor. And in that case, the defendant was charged with misdemeanor assault, and he was charged specifically with striking the victim with his hand. But at trial, he testified to a different version of events where he said the victim came at him with some object. He raised his arm in self-defense to prevent him from being hit himself, but when he did that, the object fell from the victim's hand and struck her in the face. And that was a writ case where, on a writ, he was claiming ineffective assistance of counsel because his counsel, did not request a self-defense instruction. But the Court of Criminal Appeals said in those circumstances, the defendant was not entitled to an instruction on self-defense because he did not admit to the charged conduct. And it said his defense was more of a denial of the state's elements rather than an admission to those elements and then offering a good reason. And I think that's very similar to what happened in this case. Really, I believe that it was more stressed at trial, appellant's claim that this gun went off accidentally. I didn't shoot. Somebody else caused this gun to go off. It was more of a, he didn't say, yes, I shot Mr. Sells, but here's my good reason for it. It was, no, I didn't commit this act at all. I didn't shoot the gun at all.
So the difference between Martinez and this case is, as Martinez said, I shot the gun.
He shot the gun. He admitted to the charged conduct. Whereas here, you know, appellant just did not admit to the charged conduct. And so he is asking this court to hold that he was entitled to a self-defense instruction where he neither admitted to the act itself or the culpable mental state. And, you know, essentially that would dispense with the requirements of the confession and avoidance doctrine altogether. And that's just something he's not legally entitled to. Unless the panel has any further questions, the state will rely on its brief for the remainder of its points of error and request that this court affirm the appellant's conviction.
Thank you, Mr. Wade. Mr. Gibson, rebuttal.
Thank you. My kind of general response to a lot of this is, I don't believe Ex Parte Naylor. I think that Gamino and Martinez have essentially overruled not the core holding, but the idea that you have to admit to every little part of the charged conduct. So I don't find that particularly helpful. But as far as Martinez goes, I don't think that, and I could be wrong, but I don't think that the defendant testified, hey, yeah, I fired that gun. I mean, what the Court of Criminal Appeals, their holding was, appellant admitted to pulling out the gun, firing it into the air, which I don't think we're talking about, and having his finger on the trigger when the fatal shot was fired. While he specifically denied intending to kill the victim, this alone doesn't preclude an instruction. So there was evidence in there that the mother-in-law had her finger on his and sort of forced him. So it wouldn't even really make sense for him to say, I fired the weapon. It doesn't seem like what he testified to was even a voluntary act. And if we want to get into the weeds on this, I would think that what Mr. Rodriguez appellant testified to was not far off from that. Which brings me back to kind of the facts of what occurred. I would say, with regard to the discussion, and it's an interesting one, about whether we have to look at the victim using deadly force, or was deadly force generally being used where the victim was. Hypothetically, that might be kind of interesting, but I think that a fair reading, and again, I could be wrong, but I think a fair reading of Mr. Rodriguez's testimony is that the person who was kneeling on Candido is the one that he went and grabbed, and it turned out to be the victim. And he put a pistol to his neck, and after that is when the gun went off. So, meanwhile, I think it's important not to ignore the testimony of the brother himself. He testified that, and again, Mr. Rodriguez had to have seen some of this because he testified to it, but he got sucker punched, then he hit the ground, he blacked out. He regained consciousness, but someone was choking him, and then blood's running down his throat, so he just tucked his head in while he got punched. And remember, this is not the defendant testifying, this is his brother. And he started to lose consciousness, and that's when he heard the gunshot. And when he heard the gunshot, the heavy weight that was on top of him disappeared, which I think, again, would be an inference that the person that Mr. Rodriguez testified was actually hurting Candido was indeed Mr. Sells. And based on their testimony, we would request that the court find that this was an adequate allegation of deadly force for which Mr. Rodriguez defended both himself and his brother. And because of that, we pray for a reversal. Thank you.
Thank you very much. All right, gentlemen, your case is submitted. You are free to go. You're welcome to stick around if you would like to hear the next argument. Give a second for y'all to make way for the next set of advocates.